Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Sanjay Torre, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Sanjay, you've had quite the whirlwind month, I guess. Traveling all over the planet,
exactly.
Huh? So first you were in Africa, now you're in America, now you're just doing all kinds of America's things
just
now.
Just came back from New Orleans. I loved it.
So how's that? How was Mardi Gras?
It was so much fun. It was my first time.
First time in Mardi Gras or New Orleans?
Both.
Both?
Yeah.
So how was the food?
So good. Everything Cajun.
Cajun? You like that?
Oh, yeah. I love spice.
Spicy stuff?
Yeah.
So speaking of spicy, you know, we got a spicy crowd here today.
I see that.
You see that? All right. We're going to kick off the show with our friends from Lease Query. I got George Ozzie and Jennifer Booth. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, George, before we get too far into things, you mind updating us a little bit about Lease Query? You were here a year or two ago. I guess you were kind of not at the beginning, but closer to the beginning.
Yes.
Things have changed a little, huh?
Just a little bit. I believe I was here last year. At that time, we were negotiating office space in the Dunwoody area. At the time, I believe we were about 50 people, 50 total people working on the company. If you recall, what we do is we help companies manage their leased assets, specifically as it relates to the accounting. So since in that 1 year, we are now up to about 120 people total. With about 103 in Atlanta in the Dunwoody office. We've gotten our own office. We've since expanded and filled up that office. And now we're looking for more space.
More space again.
Correct.
And you're in the lease query business.
Yes, we're in the business of querying leases, so to speak.
So how has it been leading a company for this kind of explosive growth?
Well, I mean, the one thing I can say is that I'm not exactly leading the company alone. I've got an amazing team with me, and one of them, obviously, is Jennifer. Jennifer joined us a couple of months ago, and she's our VP of accounting. So people like her actually help us move the company forward.
Sure, but when you started the company at the beginning, you had an idea, and now all of those things are coming into fruition.
Yes, it is. It's pretty hectic, I'd say.
So now, from a leadership standpoint, any advice for a person who comes from an idea and then it starts getting traction and, you know, going from a handful of people to 10 to 20 to 50 and now into the hundreds, is it the same exact process?
No.
Are you doing the same exact things?
No, not at all. In fact, I like to say that we're experiencing about 5 years of growth in 1 year, right? So everything changes. It seems like you're leading a different company every quarter, so to speak. But the one thing that I do know that I recognize is whenever things go wrong or you think bad things happen, and in the long run, they actually end up being good things because they prepare you for the future.
So don't be afraid of making mistakes or taking on challenges that might seem to be too large.
Mistakes are definitely opportunities to learn.
So that's a good philosophy.
Yes.
Look at that way. How did you learn that philosophy? Was that is your background in entrepreneurism, or you have mentors that helped you get through that?
No, I am I like to say I'm a charlatan when it comes to being, you know, an entrepreneur. I did not walk I did not decide to start a business. I noticed that there was a weakness in the marketplace and you know, wanting to help accountants, I figured that we could create software to do that.
So now your background is in the accounting, right?
Correct. That is my background.
And that's where you saw this kind of opportunity?
Yes. I saw in the company I was working for at the time, our auditors came and audited the leases, and 10 out of 10 of them were wrong. Audited another 10, and 10 out of 10 of them were wrong. And then the chief accounting officer tasked me with teaching, this was a global company, with teaching the controllers how to account for leases. And so I went there and, you know, started looking through, you know, Excel spreadsheets and creating something and figured, you know, there has to be software that does this, and looked around for the software. It didn't exist. And so I figured, you know, why not build it?
And then at that point, you weren't a technologist, right?
I was not. I certainly was not.
So you had to find the right technologist to help?
Correct. I had to find. I mean, look, in starting software, so to speak, the most important role, I guess, is the business analyst, what they call the BA, the person who writes out the requirement. So that I could do, right? I could go through and say, okay, this is exactly what it needs to do. And then you find programmers to do that. And the more work you do up front in writing the requirements, the less work you'll have to do for the programmers and the less expensive it'll be.
Now, how was it, like, did you have programmers that you knew, or this was uncharted territory for
you? This was definitely uncharted territory. What I did was I started off with a couple of freelancers, but in technically speaking, freelancers, that's what they're doing. It's a side gig. And I realized really quickly that you did not need someone who was going to treat this as a side gig. You needed someone where this would be their job. So with that, I found a company, and what they did is program. So,
and then you hired them?
Correct. I hired the company. It was an outsource out of India to begin with. And in fact, the person who wrote the first line of code still works for us at this day.
Wow. So then was that just pure chance you got the right?
Oh, no. I was very deliberate. Absolutely. I was very, very deliberate. I mean, up until, you know, looking to determine, okay, are we going to write this in, you know, using a .NET shop, or are we going to use LAMP? You know, even down to the type of language we used, I was pretty deliberate in making those choices.
But you had no background in this.
I did not.
So you were learning this as...
Where there's a will, there's a way. Yeah.
So you had to immerse yourself into the technology to know which was going to be the best long-term.
Correct. And I mean, and how I did that was I looked at other companies that were serving, you know, enterprise customers, and figured out that they were using .NET shops. So that's what made me make that call.
And then when you were doing this at the beginning, was this kind of a side hustle for you, or did you quit your job and say, look, I believe in this, I'm going all in? Because you know, accountants are usually big risk takers like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was certainly a side hustle for a couple of years, actually. And frankly speaking, I never... it seems deliberate now, but when I quit to do this full time, I quit because of health reasons. I actually got sick, and
because of stress.
It was stress related.
You had two jobs.
I did have two. I had two full time jobs. In fact, it was ironic. I guess 2 weeks ago, I was on a plane. I was boarding a plane, about to board a plane to somewhere, and the lady looks at me and she goes, "Did you spend a lot of time at Barnes & Noble?" And I go, yes. And she goes, you were working on a project, right? Because I mean, I was literally at Barnes & Noble.
That was your office?
That was my office. And I'd like to give a shout out to Barnes & Noble and the Starbucks office over there. But that was certainly where the company began.
So now, as the company has grown and you've had to add more and more players to the team, are you the same level of deliberation goes into choosing the right people to work with?
Oh yes, absolutely. I mean, one thing that I've been kind of blessed with is instinct of knowing, okay, when someone is going to be right. For instance, the moment I met Jennifer, I knew that, okay, we had to have her on our team. So with Chris, the same thing. Russell, you know, there's some people that once I met, you know, I knew, okay, this person's going to be an A player and they're going to be able to help us to get to where we want to be. So in that realm, I've been definitely blessed and lucky.
So what are some clues you have an A player?
Well, someone who's persistent and someone who's deliberate on the other side. I think Chris, our CRO, Chris and I worked together for a year before we actually had an agreement, right? And what he was trying to do was determine, okay, is this the right role? Jennifer went out with us, gosh, I think 5 or 6 times, you know, like wanted to meet all the individual key players. We had a lot of conversations. And so that tells you what their approach is going to be. I like to say you can't just determine how successful or someone's going to be in just one meeting, right? You have to determine their patterns and if their patterns are deliberate, then you know that they're also going to be deliberate when it comes to working.
So you're looking at their behaviors, not necessarily what's on a resume.
Well, the one thing that I like to do now is you look for strengths as opposed for weaknesses. Mm-hmm. So most interview processes now, people try to say, okay, what are the things that are going to make them not work and see if there's a lack of that, in lieu of saying, okay, what are the strengths and making sure that those strengths align with your existing weaknesses, because that's how you plug in holes.
So now what kind of strength were you looking to fill when you met Jennifer?
How many of them? So the biggest one is Jennifer's background is in lease accounting. She worked for I should let Jennifer speak first.
All right, Jennifer, jump in here. So you were working for a large firm in the past, and then you said, hey, let me just go for this small 100-person firm. Let me toss everything aside. Again, very accounting-like thinking.
Yes. Yes, I grew up in public accounting,
right,
and was there for a number of years auditing companies and assisting them with their accounting. And then in the last couple years had been assisting companies with their lease accounting. I was one of our lease experts within the firm. And happened by chance to meet George and see a demo of his product and was really impressed with the product and with George's focus on the accounting within the software.
So were you seeing the same kind of problems that he was seeing?
Yes, I had been helping companies account for leases, and especially when you get into some of the more complex leases, it's, you know, a very manual process, and most companies don't have the expertise in-house to do it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really liked the fact that the lease query product was accounting focused and made it easy for companies to get the accounting right.
Mm-hmm. So then you were working, and there was a period you didn't know about George, right? And
right.
You were just going about, hey, this is what I do. I'm an accountant. I work for a large firm. This is the dream. I'm living the dream, right? That was your career path.
Right.
It was very logical. No one said you were crazy for doing this. That all made perfect sense, right?
Right, yep.
But then you meet George, and then you see this kind of amazing way of some software that's doing something different in the marketplace. And you're like, hey, let me not do this normal career and then jump ship to this kind of startup-y new venture.
Yes, yes. It was certainly a big decision and a big change. But throughout my career, one of the components I had really liked was helping our clients. And so I really liked the fact that here I was able to help our customers directly and, you know, reach a lot more customers and help them a lot more than I could before, right? We have a software. It makes it a lot easier for them. You can touch customers a lot easier.
Now, you're doing this, and you're accountants.
Yes.
Accountants are known not to be risk takers. Is that a false theory that's out there?
That's a myth? That's true.
So then you're at this firm that is a name player firm, and you're like, I think I've had enough here. I'm ready to go at them. Was your family like, yeah, go for it? Everybody was supportive? This seemed like the right move?
Yeah, everybody was supportive of a change. You know, it was certainly a different dimension, but it was something I was really interested in, really impressed with the product. I had seen a number of other products that were more management focused and not
accounting focused. Right.
And so immediately when I saw the product and had seen a demo from George, you know, I knew this was something that I believed in and could get behind.
Right. And then how long did it take for you to intellectually say, okay, this seems like a good move, and then to really, you know, hand in your notice?
I think it was about 3 months from the time I met George to when I started. So.
Wow. So in a short period of time, you made this a big life decision.
Yes.
So do you have...
That's actually not short.
That's not short?
I mean, for most people, that'll take... the decision would probably take a month.
It's not an impulse. That sounds like an impulse decision, like if I'm going to buy, what kind of car I'm going to buy.
Well, I mean, it took me 48 hours to determine what kind of car I was going to buy.
But it took you 3 years to quit your job.
It did. Yes.
It took her 3 months.
Well, I we weren't starting from scratch. So
you do this. So you make this change. So now you're in a different environment, right? This is totally different than where you were. So what pros and cons of being in this kind of startup chaotic world where it was probably less chaotic in some ways?
Yes. No, I love everybody that we're working with. Everybody really has a positive attitude and really wants to help all of our customers. I work with the business analysts that George had mentioned before, which has been really interesting to see the technology side of it and, you know, be able to bring the accounting focus and work with the individuals to help see then the result come through in the software has been exciting.
And then, you're all in, you're immersed now, right?
Yes.
This is, you're not looking back. This is now your new life.
Right.
So now, how do you go about this when it's kind of a blank sheet of paper where you're working now, right? And you're kind of authoring your own future and really integral part of the team, whereas maybe you were more of a cog in a machine and then the other.
Yeah, I think having had the experience, I think helps, especially when you're coming into an entrepreneurial company, being able to bring some of the processes that I had seen before. I also work with our technical accounting managers and have been adding some additional rigor just in terms of training and all of that, that, you know, we hadn't had the opportunity to have before. So I think, you know, some of that background helps, but then also just the entrepreneurial spirit and being able to, you know, see a need and be able to, you know, George lets everybody kind of, if you see a need, go fill it and bring your suggestions, which has been exciting.
So now let's get into the weeds a little bit about the accounting part of this. So this is an area where, like you, George, you were saying that a lot of mistakes were made and maybe opportunities missed for the clients. And this software kind of catches some of that and it helps the client be more successful, make more money, save money.
Correct. I mean, obviously, it's a compliance play first and foremost. So it's kind of inconsistent to measure it as a return on investment. I will say, though, that in our early, I think our first six customers, probably our sixth or seventh customer, we saved them $2.5 million in a tenant improvement allowance. What happened was that the company was a bank that acquired another bank, and they had a tenant improvement allowance that succeeded purchase, you know, and thank goodness there was no expiration date. So after we read the lease, entered into the system, we expected to see this liability represented a tenant's improvement allowance, and there was none on their books. And so we asked them, and they said, well, we never even knew that we had this allowance. So they went back, and they were able to recoup that $2.5 million. Now, ironically, we gave them a bill for like $20,000, and they complained. Yes. So that, I thought that was that's accounting for you.
But that's so is that where you're like, maybe I should raise my rates?
Well, that was actually pre-Chris. So the wonderful thing about what we're doing here is, you know, I have a passion for helping the customers, helping the clients. And as you mentioned, Jennifer just mentioned, you know, she loves that part as well. So we, as a company, the way we're focused is, you know, we hire accountants and we hire accountants who are passionate about accounting and specifically who are passionate about helping other clients, right? I mean, we pride ourselves on having delighted customers. That is the goal. Now, obviously, when that's your goal, then the money making part kind of suffers, right? Because we just want people to use the product and to make their lives better as it relates to lease accounting. That's where Chris comes aboard, right? And the entire sales team and customer success, right? Marketing. Those guys make us we don't have to worry about the other parts of the business, i.e., you know, billing or, you know, pricing. You know, Chris and his team handles that. So I think that dichotomy has been something that's been beautiful to navigate.
But when you created this product, it was built to help the clients not miss some opportunities, right? It was helping them save money, make money.
Well, it's essentially, yes, I mean, that's a secondary play. But frankly speaking, it's an accounting software that helps companies be compliant with the new lease accounting standards. That's the first, second, and third reason we exist, right? Is there's been this huge change in accounting for leases that now companies are going to have to are now required to put liabilities on their balance sheet to represent future lease payments. Before, these were called off balance sheet transactions, and the math is really not that simple. You don't just put a number on your balance sheet. You have to actually go through a calculation to do it. Our software helps them get that math right.
And then, Jennifer, this is where you come into play. You're the math person.
Yes, she is.
Yes.
So how do you stay on top of all this regulation and compliance rules? Doesn't it change constantly?
She has a book that she whips out whenever I say. Yeah. I think, you know, this we had a conversation, I believe, on Friday. It was a Friday or Thursday. And we were talking about one specific part of the rules. And I go, you know what? I really don't think this is in the spirit of the rules. And she's like, no, George. And she whips, literally just goes open, opens the exact page, and shows me here is exactly what it says. So, yes.
So not only do you have to deal with what it says, you have to deal with the spirit of what it says?
Yeah, that's always
been. Is there an algorithm, a spirit algorithm you guys have in there?
Yes. That's always been hard in working with companies because the accounting guidance is not necessarily logical, right? And so many times I have to explain to customers that, yeah, I know this may not seem logical, but this is the accounting guidance, and so we have to follow it. And I think the fact, you know, that's one of the great things about this software is when you put your lease information in, you know, the accounting is processed for you. And so it makes it so there's not as many of those questions or misses for a customer.
That so the software, they don't have to keep calling you up like George does. Right. The software is doing the heavy lifting.
Right. It is. At the inception of a contract, you would put in all of the key information, you know, start date, end date, all of your payment information, if you have any options to purchase, that type of thing. And then the algorithms within the software will create the accounting, you know, until the end of the contract. And so it'll create your journal entries for each period. And then one of the really great things about our software is the disclosure reports that we have. George mentioned the new accounting guidance that went into effect January of this year for most public companies. And it has additional expanded disclosures that are going to be pretty time consuming for a customer if they don't have software. Anytime you amend a lease or create a new lease, you would have to update your spreadsheets. And so our tool will do all of that for you and just spit out your disclosure that you can just copy into your financial statements.
And if they didn't have the software, they'd have to manually do all of that?
Right, yep.
And that's true, but that's how it's done, right? That's not an unusual way of doing it.
Historically, that was not, yeah. Before this lease accounting guidance, this new lease accounting guidance, most companies did it manually. And so.
And that's where mistakes can happen, exactly. And inconsistencies. Now, so are you informing the algorithm? Like, are you having an input in that part of it?
Yes, yes. I work with the business analyst and our programmers. And so the business analysts and I, you know, look through whatever the new feature that we need to add is, and then make sure, you know, it's in accordance written out with the accounting guidance. And then we give it to our programmers who, you know, will implement that in the software.
Now, is this something that's federal or is it state by state or local?
Overall, it's federal from a U.S. GAAP perspective. So there's the U.S. Accounting guidance, and then there's also international accounting guidance, IFRS. And so our software complies with both requirements.
And then, but those are changing constantly?
They changed. The big change went into effect 2019 for most companies this year. Mm-hmm. And so it's a little more static now. There was a lot of changes, you know, back in 2018 as they were trying to tweak the guidance. But now that it's gone into effect, there's not as many changes. Everybody's just trying to adopt what is out there.
So is that usually how it happens? They'll make a big change and then they go through kind of this transition period where they're adopting and seeing where the problems are, and then they'll make another big change and then rinse and repeat.
Yes, to some extent they'll have the big change, and then to the extent that tweaks are needed along the way, you know, they'll come out with adjustments, you know, if you know somebody's not understanding or if there wasn't an intent to the guidance that's not coming through.
What if there's like some legal challenge, and does that force changes sometimes? Like precedents of somebody, you know, battling and saying that's not right, and they go to court.
What happens is prior to to it being released, like if you talk about the general timeline, what you have, it starts off with what's called the EITF, the Emergent Issues Task Force. They determine, okay, we have a problem, we've identified the problem, and we're going to come out with a way to fix it. And then they kind of give a general outline of, okay, this is what we're thinking of. And then, you know, the boards meet about once a quarter on that specific topic. And then after that, they issue what's called an exposure draft. And that exposure draft goes out to comment. Right. And during that comment period, that's when companies can come in and say, OK, we don't think this is right, or we think you should tweak this or do, you know, something. This was such a big change that it was actually released twice, which is very rare. Right. There were two exposure drafts that were written. And then finally, they issued the final standard. And even within the final standard, there was a big change that came out afterwards. Once again, this is not often, but there was a big change that said companies did not have to restate prior financials. That was the biggest change that they've had since releasing this guidance. Now, once again, though, it's not really, okay, we release something and then rinse and repeat. As Jennifer said, it's more tweaks that they'll do to the existing guidelines.
And then that impacts your software?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Then you have to adjust accordingly.
Absolutely. Right. We have to stay on top of it. I mean, that's part of the quote unquote service component of our
software as a service, because that's how Correct. They buy this, right?
That's right. Exactly right.
Now, are there any Atlanta firms, or what types of Atlanta firms are impacted by these new standards?
Well, pretty much every single large, if you have to issue GAAP financials, what are called GAAP financials, GAAP means generally accepted accounting principles. That's what companies in the United States use. If you have to issue GAAP financials, then this will, and you have a lease, right, one lease or more, then this will affect you. It's not just real estate, I should stress. It's also equipment. It's also vehicles. It's also, you know, laptops. I mean, whatever it is that where you have a lease, then this standard will affect you.
Now, what's the sweet spot for a client for you? It's not the guy with one lease.
It's certainly not the person with one lease. So the interesting thing is the way we price our product, I'll say, maybe we start with that, is companies that have, you know, 100 or less leases. That's our minimum. However, we have a lot of clients that have, you know, 30 or 25. And we have clients that have all the way up to, you know, 25,000, something like that. So now at the end of the day, though, that the range for us that we've noticed, that we've seen, it's about 500 to 1,500 leases, leased assets. That's kind of what we've seen. However, we have clients that have 7 leases in our system. And as I said, we have clients that, you know, higher 20,000s.
So then as you do this and more and more companies adopt it, you'll get a better picture of who the ideal client is. Even though anybody, you know, pretty much everybody can use it.
Well, I mean, so we always talk about the ideal client, right? I mean, this is where we're different, because it's literally every single company. So we did an analysis to determine what percentage of our clients work in what industry, and the highest percentage was 11%. Right, and that was financial institutions. So at the end of the day, I mean, the retail was probably another, you know, 8%, and then restaurant was probably another 9%. My point is, it's very, we have a very variegated group of clients. So it's very hard to narrow it down to say, okay, this is our ideal candidate. Basically, once again, if you have to issue GAAP financials, and if you have more than 20 leases, then this is a problem for you.
But a challenge when it's for everybody is it's hard to market to everybody.
We
but that's not your problem, right? That's Chris's problem.
Well, what we do is we're a content writing machine, right? We have a great marketing team, and with Reva, I mean, she literally interviews us and, you know, gets our thoughts on paper. It's amazing the kind of work she does. And then companies that have the problem identify themselves. They read the article or they read the blog, because once again, this is such a big change. When they read it, they go, okay, this is a problem that I'm facing. Let's reach out to these guys, because obviously they have a good plug on the engine.
And your solution is different than, I mean, this is dramatically different than the way they've been doing business.
Correct.
So at the minimum, they're intrigued by the possibility there could be a better way.
Well, it's not. So we like to say we will get you compliant. So once again, it's about being compliant, right? We will
and
get
the
you,
penalty of non-compliance good. Right. So then you're playing on their fear
Correct.
Of getting in trouble.
Correct.
And no one wants to be the one that on their watch they got in trouble.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You do not want to get a comment letter from the SEC saying that
Right.
you did something wrong. Or you certainly do not want to restate your financials.
So now what's next for you?
Whew.
Let's go with Jennifer first. She's new. She doesn't know.
Right now we're just trying to help all of our customers through. This is the big first quarter that everybody's
right.
on this accounting. So helping them figure out their disclosures. And then looking forward, the governmental standards are coming out. The GASB guidance will be effective later this year. And so I think we'll start on that train.
Now, are you building a team?
We are, yes.
What about you personally? You're the queen of accounting at the firm.
Yes. We've started to expand already. We now have a senior manager in my technical accounting group who was promoted from within, and looking for some additional technical expertise.
So now what kind of talent do you need? Who are your A players? What do they look like?
Certainly you have to have a background in accounting, right? And with that background, but then individuals who are, you know, team players and just interested go-getters, like to, you know, see a problem and try to figure out how to solve it.
So, like, do they come from an audit background? What are they kind of characteristics typically?
Yeah, I think most of our accountants have come from an audit background or a consulting background within one of the the big four accounting firms. You kind of need that base, a good base of accounting to be able to help your customers.
Right. And then, so you can't not have that knowledge.
Right. That's a lot harder to teach. Right. And then.
But once they have that, then there's kind of characteristics that more entrepreneurial. They got to be very customer focused and care and solve problems, like all that other kind of softer skills come into play.
Yes.
And then what about you, George?
Well,
you need new office space. You mentioned.
Well,
that.
Yes, we're looking at we're certainly looking at office space now. Either expanding within the building that we are in, or looking for something else that once again we can call our own. It's just that's one big thing that we're facing. We're also trying to. You just mentioned, you know, the software is not for the person with one lease. Well, guess what?
You're working on that too.
We're working on that as well.
That's the roadmap.
I mean, I guess last week on Wednesday, we gave a demo on Wednesday at 4 p.m. And on Thursday by 2 p.m., the potential client had signed their agreement with us. Why? Because they adopted manually. And after that experience, they said, absolutely not. We need software. So that's how much of a pain point it is. And it doesn't matter whether you have one or two leases. The math is still the same. So there's companies out there that have, you know, one or two leases that may be large companies that, you know, are looking for a solution, but they're not willing to pay, you know, the minimum for 100 leases. And so there's something there for them as well.
And if somebody wanted to learn more about LeaseQuery, what's the best way to do that?
Go to www.leasequery.com. That's LEASEQUERY, one word, www.leasequery.com.
And then if you got one lease or 100 or 1,000 or 10,000,
we want to talk
LeaseQuery.
Yes.
First call, right?
First call. That's all. That's a tagline for someone else, right?
You can use it. Good job, George and Jennifer. Thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Thank you very much.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have a good friend of Atlanta Business Radio, Doug Pizik, who is a wood artist who has an amazing entrepreneurial story from, you know, you were in their shoes somewhat, right? You were
absolutely.
In the corporate world.
Yep, corporate world, and I've done business consulting. I worked for a lot of major corporations. I worked for small companies, and I gave guidance to a lot of players. And I just loved hearing the LeaseQuery story. I was able to relate to a lot of it, and I appreciated a lot of it. And I felt, you know, just a lot of empathy with the good growth you guys are going through. And congratulations.
And then Doug pulled the ripcord, went a totally different way. If you thought, Jennifer, you thought you had problems with your family. Imagine a guy who says, I'm giving up all that corporate stuff and I'm going to make wood art.
Yep.
Quite a change.
Quite a change. Yeah, imagine getting up one day and going, gee, I wonder how I can make a lot less money.
And spend more time doing it.
Exactly. But the thing is, it's a whole big giant growth opportunity. I had started off fortunate enough, I was able to talk to you, Lee, a year ago about some of this. But I was working with the New York Stock Exchange and a spinoff company, Front, that they spun off and helping to grow that spinoff company here in Atlanta. And then just decided that I wanted to do something different.
But you were always doing this.
I was always doing it. So I was doing the side, but what's really interesting, I was doing it as a business is very, very different.
Right. It was a hobby. It was just like a passion thing that you enjoyed.
It was a passion, very strong one. I mean, it was a passion which I ended up investing a lot in space in my home, in equipment, and I was actually starting to get into art galleries. So with that, I realized I could do this full time and still take advantage of my business background and not give that up. By running it as a business and taking advantage of my background that I had. My corporate background applies very strongly to the growth that I'm doing right now.
Right, which a lot of artists, their heads explode when they say
it doesn't
when
work.
They hear that.
It doesn't work. Someone just goes, gee, I'm a good painter, I'm going to paint, and I know whoever will come by it. No, the old adage, build it and they will come, doesn't always work.
Well, it's called starving artists for a reason, right?
Exactly. And my goal was to become an artist that wasn't starving.
So now, how did you go about that?
Well, it was my wife and I worked out a financial plan. We figured out what would we do. We'd assume that for some time that it would not be lucrative, which is so true and expected.
Right.
Just like any startup company, you're going to be building up debt. You're going to not assume that you have a large payoff day one. And you can't always assume with any company that you're going to have a steady income stream. It takes a while to get there. So we knew that going into it. We planned for it. And we knew that financially we'd be sound. And we saved up and we waited until we had the right amount saved up. And I was able to prove that my art would sell in galleries before I pulled the ripcord, as you said.
Now, so you had to build up an inventory of art
as well.
Right?
Yes.
Because those are that's your assets to sell.
That's true. So I was doing that. I've always been creating, but it was always just for myself or for gifts. And now I was able to start building up the inventory. So
now you had to be strategic, right? Now you're looking at this, I have to build things that someone's going to buy, not just art for art's sake.
Well, actually, I don't agree with that. And the reason being is, if you're going to make, I think that if you start making something strictly for someone else and thinking what's going to sell, then you lose a big part of the creative advantages that makes your art unique and special in the first place, that would make an artist want to be an artist as it is. So there's a balance that's there. I could be making cutting boards, for example, all day long, selling them. They would sell great, but there wouldn't be the passion behind that for me. It is for some, but for me, I don't feel the passion in that. I like to bring things up to a whole new level, create things that no one has ever seen before. And when you create something that no one has ever seen before, there's no guarantee that someone's going to want it. So I make things with an eye that I feel I would enjoy based on feedback I've gotten from others. That said, if I have a choice between making two or three different things and I would enjoy making any of them, and I feel that one of them would be a better seller, I will focus on the better seller that's out there. And it's really important then to make sure your pendulum isn't swung so far to the avant-garde or obscure, which I don't do, that no one would have any interest in it, or so far on the commercial side that you're no longer an artist, but instead just a factory spitting out things. Mm-hmm.
But that continuum is a balance. Because there's artists on either side of that.
There are. And there's nothing wrong with anywhere in the pendulum you are at all. As long as you're enjoying yourself and you're not a burden on society along the way. So I like that pendulum being swung in multiple places. And I've done some very unusual commissions in the past. But I do try to make sure that the work that I do has me in it as far as my artistry, while simultaneously making sure that I'm fulfilling the needs of those which have hired me to do work for them.
Now, your work is in wood. Is some of your work functional, where like people can use like drawers or something like that, their table that I can use every day, or is it stuff that I hang on the wall or it's on the shelf that people look at but don't actually use?
It's a combination. What I'm most known for is my art boxes. Most people do not buy them to put things in because they are rather ornate and also rather expensive, some of them, not all, but some. So therefore, I make some boxes that are $150. I don't make too many of those, but people can use those functionally. I make some that are also $2,000 and $3,000. People usually don't throw their keys in a box like that. They
Right.
put it on the center of their dining room table. At the same time, I've just recently created some art pedestals. I realized that there are people who want to display the art uniquely, so I've created some unique designs. So I've done furniture aspects as far as pedestals go.
A pedestal to hold the box.
An art pedestal that would hold the art
this
box.
Is getting very meta.
Exactly.
Then a house that holds a pedestal that holds the art box.
It's funny you mention it's meta. I actually create purely artwork, which I call my meta series, mm-hmm. which is funny you say, because it's, for example, large wall art pieces, and embedded within that piece, it's made of smaller art pieces that make up the larger, and hence the name meta. it's art made out of art. It's a great feeling to be able to do that.
So now when you started this, and you were coming from the corporate background, and you started kind of going all in the art, right? At some point,
correct.
You had to separate the corporate from... Or there was a period where you worked corporate and was doing this on the side, but at some point you stopped working in a corporate setting and just went all in on this.
13 months ago, I left the corporate world officially. I still have my finger in it because I do actually enjoy the business side of things. I am consulting, or I should say I'm an advisor to a startup company, mm-hmm. as well as on the board of a of the Terminus Modern Ballet Theater. So they, I provide business guidance to this company, which mm-hmm. is an amazing Atlanta company.
And that, but now when you're out there as an artist, are you kind of on social media? You're doing all the marketing as an artist, not a consultant, really.
Correct. I don't market myself as a business consultant at all anymore mm-hmm. because that's not where my primary focus is. And also, I don't want to muddy the waters.
Right.
At the same time, to be honest, I'm realistic. Anyone who wants to hire me as a business consultant, if they see all my artwork out there, they're going to be questioning, just as George mentioned earlier, about freelancers,
right.
you know, doing it part-time. And it's I completely agree with George's aspect as far as that goes. So, yes, I'm on social media quite a bit, focusing strictly on art. In fact, I'm going to be in an art show coming up, and there's a big focus on social media at the show. It's the American Craft Show. It's the 30th year here in Atlanta. It's going to be at the Galleria. They've been pushing all the artists to utilize the tagline, the hashtag ACC Atlanta. And the reason being is they recognize that social media is a very big aspect. And anyone who wants to follow what's happening at the show, we're able to follow the artists, see what's happening by looking at that hashtag as an example of how social media is being utilized today.
Now, can you track any of your work that sold through, like, hey, I was on Instagram and that eventually led to a sale?
I have actually. Facebook last year.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up having a piece. It was in one of my museum pieces. It was at the Marietta Cobb Museum of Art. Someone saw images of it on Facebook, reached out to me through Facebook messaging and said, I would love that piece. Is it available? We started talking and ended up selling that piece to them. It was one of my more expensive sales.
And then when something like that occurs, it still requires a conversation. It's not like they're going to a page and just clicking buy now.
Correct. I haven't set up my website for selling direct. One of the reasons I haven't done it yet is every piece I make is a one of a kind.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of time to cycle through and set up a site for that. I may do it at some point, but for right now, I'm just still working on just having the general inventory and using my site more as a gallery to generate interest. People can go to my site. They can sign up. They can send me inquiries. They're able to sign up for my newsletter, things like that. But otherwise, most of my selling is done through people contacting me, commissioning me, or through art galleries. I'm in a number of art galleries. And also, even the High Museum of Art is selling my work in their gift shop right now.
So now, how do you kind of network with art galleries and get on their radar so they choose you in their limited, obviously that's limited, finite space?
It is, and it is very much a challenge, and one of the things that as that artists have a very, very hard time with. Some galleries will find you, and I was reached out by a couple of galleries and asked whether I wanted to be in their gallery or not. I'm actually rather picky about which galleries I go into because I want to make sure that my work is comparable there with the clientele that they have, not just to throw it anywhere I can. That's not helping me, and it's not helping the gallery. I will reach out to galleries myself. Most of them will not talk to me because they don't talk to any artists. A lot of galleries, especially the higher-end ones, want to pick their artists, so that makes it very, very hard to do. However, I have managed to get into four different galleries. One of them from invitation for a few select shows. Three of them right now I spoke with and I said, we'd love to try your work out. And I've hung up. I'm currently in two galleries in the Atlanta area. One of them is up in Blue Ridge, Georgia, and another one out in Santa Fe, which is a beautiful gallery, and it's right in the heart of the art district out there.
Now, when you're working with the galleries, is it something where they say, okay, send me these 10 pieces and you ship it to them? And
It's almost like that. So what happens is they like your work. I'll bring it in. There are times that they want specific pieces, and you bring in those. But most of the time, I'll bring in, you know, a lot for them to physically look at for those that are local. Sometimes they just take everything I bring in to show them, and they hang them on the wall. And sometimes they just go, well, I only want two or three of those. For the gallery that was out in Santa Fe, we spoke for some time on the phone about what works in that gallery and price points and such. And based on that, I geared a series of wall pieces for them that was a unique series that we both thought would work well in their gallery, and I sent them photos in advance to confirm before I shipped them out that they were comfortable with them, and they were, and I shipped them out, and they're hanging on the wall out there now.
Now, as you move forward, do you think it's just more of the same at this point? You just got to meet more people, more galleries, more, you know, potential clients?
It's a really great question. In 2 weeks, I mentioned the American Craft Show that's coming to Atlanta. My first time doing a show like this. My big push isn't to be doing arts and craft shows. It's really not where the type of work I do is a little bit more higher end than that. And at the same time, it's not where I'd like to spend most of my time. Not that there's anything wrong with those shows. It's just for me personally, it's not the best thing. But this show is a special show. It's a higher-end indoor show, and I'm really hoping at that show that in addition to selling some works, I'm able to find higher-end galleries and designers and people who'd like to do commissions. So it's all about marketing, and what I really want to do going forward is either find galleries that want to really promote me, which is difficult to do, but if I can find the right gallery and they're interested, it would be a great opportunity. And simultaneously, commissions, I just love commissions. This ties in with my business background. To be able to create something that never existed before is a big passion of mine. That's why art is a big passion. To imagine something that never, ever was seen on the face of the earth and make it happen. And that's part of why I loved, and I still love, my business corporate background, is because it was to be able to create something that never existed before. George mentioned it earlier. Something didn't exist. And he made something that wasn't there, that there was a need and an enjoyment, and you can hear the passion in his voice when he talked about it. I feel the same way about everything I've ever created in my business background, and I feel about it now with the art that I create. So be able to take that drive for commissions is great. It's almost like creating a project charter with someone. I will listen very carefully to my clients. What do they want? Why do they want it? Where do they want it? What's their price point? What do they like? And I'm able to take all that and create something that's still my art, something that's unique, that came out of my imagination, but inspired by their needs and their wants that fit what they want to do. And when I'm done creating it, I've never had a client that just wasn't thrilled with what I created. And I think a lot of that, like I said, has to do with the fact that I listened to them first, but still put my own touch on it, and we end up with a great partnership.
Now, the people that commission this type of art, are they buying other wood art, and then they find you as amongst the wood artists they like, and then they're like, okay, I'm going to buy a bunch of this guy's work? Is that how it typically falls?
There is no typical. I mean, I've created work for two past Home Depot executives. They got to know me because I spent a long time working actually at the Home Depot headquarters, and they found out who I was working there. And then later when they knew me, and then when they discovered that I did art, they reached out. And one of them was just last year. It was a former executive. He was following me on Facebook because we connected way back then.
But Home Depot, they sell wood, like they're wood-oriented people.
Well, that's true. They do sell wood. And in fact, just as a quick side note, there's a board out there that promotes Southern Yellow Pine, which is sold at Home Depot. Total coincidence there. But they saw me at a what's called a makers conference.
Right.
And now they're reaching out to me to highlight how you can create art out of Southern Yellow Pine.
Right.
It's an interesting work there. But to answer your original question about how people find me for these commissions, that's where social media helps quite a bit. It's also where networking helps quite a bit. And it's where making sure people can see you at places like the show that's coming up in a couple of weeks makes a big difference. And people can see it and touch it. They're willing to go forward and be able to – they trust you. There's a huge amount of trust associated with this. One thing that's important for me is I tell everyone, no matter what the commission is, no obligation to buy. Wait till you see the finished piece. I don't want anyone to ever, ever have buyer's remorse. I want them to be – thrilled and excited to have something unique in their home and not feel like, oh crap, I can't believe I spent the money on this. So therefore, everybody has the option to not buy it, and I'll just put it into my inventory. I've yet had anyone, though, not just immediately grab what I've made for them.
Well, Doug, if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the coordinates to see your work?
Well, like I said, if they want to see it in person, almost all my work is going to be at the American Craft Show at the Galleria coming up. They can check out my website, which is Doug Pizik, www.dougpizik.com.
That's Doug, P-I-S-I-K.
Correct. I was going to spell that as well because I've learned through my entire life I always have to spell it. And also, if they go to Doug Pizik, D-O-U-G-P-I-S-I-K, on Instagram, I post almost every day. People get to see, I post quick videos of work in progress, time-lapse videos, a few how-tos, some finished pieces. And people can reach out any way they'd like.
Good stuff. Well, Doug, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me back. I love talking to you guys.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Sanjay Touré. We'll see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.